We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your host, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 358. Another week, another complete ass-whooping of the Baltimore Orioles. You are very proud of your fake prediction that wasn't really a prediction, that was couched, that was only said after the Yankees lost the first two out of three.
I don't know why you keep saying that. Why do you keep saying that? Because I literally just proved to you that I said it before that.
No, you sent me the clip, and the entire clip was you saying, I don't want to argue about this. No, people don't really care about
it. It's March. People love it. It's March 28th is the clip. Mm-hmm. Okay, is when I sent it to you.
It was our preview episode, our season prediction
episode. It was the predictions episode.
Yep.
Predictions episode. It was before the season started.
Yeah.
Okay? Before the season. I have in my notes that 17-2. You tried to persuade me into 19-0 is what happened. And I was like, yeah, they should. They should go 19-0. The prediction itself, 17-2.
I tried to
before the season, before they played the Orioles, and the only reason that was in there, the two were in there, is because that's baseball season. And I clearly said that.
I tried to dissuade you from saying 19-0 because of your prediction in 2018. Of 19-0 against the Rays, and then the Yankees struggled all season against the Rays. So you said there is no reason the Yankees should lose even one single game to the Orioles, and I said, "Are you really going to do this again?" And that's when you said, "Okay, fine, 17-2." It was still, you know what? I'll give you 50%. I'll give you half credit.
What this is, sour grapes. It's you. You not making any predictions. The only ones you did were ridiculous. And one of them had to do with John Sterling making calls in London, which he did not do. Not one time. not one British call.
Well, you know, and his agent, someone in his booth should have been like, John, make some better home run calls. We're in London. He better have something for Iowa next year.
What he was trying to do is give the people the real John Sterling. Now looking back on it, Monday morning quarterback, I understand it. He wanted to give the people of the UK the authentic John Sterling. And I appreciate
that. No one
in
the UK was listening to WFAN.
They heard the bits.
They were listening to the British pandemonium box office. Didi Gregorius, he's box office.
Absolute box office.
That's what they were listening to.
It was good. They heard the clips. They heard John.
So Yankees finished up their season against the Orioles 17-2. I mean, it's an unbelievable run that they went on after, like we said, losing two out of the first three in that first weekend. And the big thing I remember you and I talked about on that Monday episode right after that first series was, are we really going to go through this again this year where they're playing inferior opponents and it looks like they just have they just fall asleep, they take them for granted, or whatever it may be, they just play down to their competition. And that's when Judge said, we got to play backs against our wall, 162 games a year, we can't take anybody for granted. And that seems to be what they did for the rest of the season against Baltimore. But I was nervous that, oh, here we go again. This is going to be the difference in the AL East. It's not winning games against Baltimore. It's not winning games against team you should be wiping the floor with.
You know, when you're watching the games and you're seeing how inferior the players are, compare even the players that, I mean, granted, we have different names today, a lot of different names in the lineup, but they're playing out of their minds. And you look over across the lineup score and you're looking at what these guys are rolling out there, and you see Trey Mancini, you see a couple other guys that are having some good years, but you know, the pitching never changed. Pitching's been terrible for, literally like my entire life. I feel like since Mike Mussina, it's been bad. Like, what was that guy? Daniel Cabrera is one of those guys that flashed in the pan for like a minute or two. But, you know, they've just been terrible. Their pitching staff has never been addressed. And it is what it is. And when you look at what the Yankees are rolling out there and the fact that they have a much more balanced team this year, like the pitching doesn't even need to be good. Like just be efficient and limit damage because you're gonna score 9 runs a game.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's don't fall too far behind. And even if they end up blowing a lead, which Luis Sessa sort of let the Orioles back into two different games this weekend, you knew they were never gonna even come back fully. And even if they did come back fully, the Yankees were just going to take the lead the following inning. This seemed to be the pattern every single game was, oh, Orioles are making it interesting. Oh, Yankees tack on a couple runs.
At no point during the entire, I don't know, I'd say the last three series, maybe four, did I feel like we were going to lose a game.
No.
At no point did I feel like that game was out of balance and we're like, uh-oh. The only time I was nervous is when they had like 5,000 kids in the stadium, and that was going to be for things had nothing to do with baseball, but everything to do with like the baseball gods and like, you know, just showing those kids something. I was nervous about the kids. I'm like, well, what if the baseball gods like show the kids something?
Well, that's,
you
know, the
like
thing.
That's what made me nervous.
That's the thing about baseball. Even though you should be winning every game against them, something eventually will happen. So I know people were talking on Twitter, oh, the Yankees could play the Orioles 100 more times this season and win 100 games. They probably win about 97 of them.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I built in the two-game cushion.
Some fun stats on the Yankees season offensively against the Orioles. So as a team, they hit 303, 386, 632. It's 204 for 673. They homered in every single game they played against them, and they hit 61 total home runs. They scored 151 runs in the 19 games. Gleyber Torres was an absolute wrecking crew. He hit 13 home runs. He tried so desperately to get his 14th home run to tie the Lou Gehrig record. Couldn't come through with it. But sneakily, Gary Sanchez hit 10 bombs off of the Orioles, and he didn't play in half the frigging games, it seemed like, because he's been injured. So everyone's talking about Gleyber because of the Gary Thorne clips, Paul O'Neill running into the Gary Thorne booth and all that kind of stuff, and it was a lot of fun. And every time Gleyber hit another three-run home run against them, in my mind, I was like, does this team have any self-respect for themselves? Are they going to throw at Gleyber Torres? Just, I'm not saying try and injure him. Just throw at his butt. Do something. You got to do something different. And the thing they chose to do was intentionally walk him when they're already down by 5 runs. They intentionally walked somebody down by 5 runs.
To load the bases.
Do you know how much real estate Gleyber Torres has in the brains of the Baltimore Orioles pitching staff? If they are intentionally walking him down by 5 runs, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen.
That's a Brandon Hyde call. That's what that is. That's a managerial
scare. He's got real estate
scared.
In every mm-hmm. – he owns beachfront property in every single one of those players and managers and coaches' brains.
It's hilarious that happened. I mean, when you're getting beat that bad and you're a bad team, I don't – for me, like, I don't think it calls for like throwing at somebody, but you can pitch them inside. You can walk them in different ways. You don't have to throw the ball over the plate. But the problem is, here's the problem with that. Their pitching staff is so bad.
I know. So bad.
They very well could have. That was the game plan for half of his at bats, maybe. And the ball just leaked over the plate. You know, like, how do you know? When you're that bad and you can't locate pitches, then, you know, there's bigger problems. It's like, you know, it just the ball ends up over the plate and Gleyber Torres ends up smashing it. So we gave a lot of t-shirts out, that's for sure.
Almost.
A lot of t-shirts.
You might have to pick somebody else next year because Gleyber Torres, if he's got 19 more games against the Orioles, might put us out of business.
I pick a new person every year. We've had Didi, career home. Actually, the first one we ever picked was A-Rod, who had the freaking resurgence.
Right.
And A-Rod started hitting home runs. I'm like, what is happening here? And then it was Didi. We actually had Didi for 2 years, and then Gleyber. So
maybe you pick Aaron Judge next year, so we can get him back to form.
I don't know. I feel like it could be a reverse action. So t-shirt time has been good for everybody. Really, when they're picked, their name is called. They have career highs in home runs. So
we gotta filter that information into the Yankees clubhouse. It's sort of like the reverse Madden jinx.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully the nerds have some algorithms for different Yankee accounts on Twitter, and they're seeing what's happening.
Another sign that this is a different Yankees team than last year. So doubleheaders this season, they played 6 of them, and they went 11-1. They swept them all except the one against the Mets, which I think is one of the more impressive stats facts of the season, because the cliche goes you're going to split doubleheaders even if you're playing shitty teams. It's hard to sweep doubleheaders. Well, they swept Baltimore twice. They beat Kansas City, swept Kansas City, swept Boston, swept Tampa. Like I said, split with the Mets. So it's not like, I mean, Boston and Tampa are two tough opponents, and they swept them. The Mets were crappy back when they played them. They split then, and the Mets are good now. But, I mean, even you play crappy teams like Baltimore and Kansas City, to sweep them, to not just say to yourself, well, it's a doubleheader. If we lose, we lose. It's huge. I think it shows a lot about this team.
I think it definitely shows a lot about the mentality, and also is a, you know, it speaks on the depth of the team too, because when you have when you're playing a doubleheader, you're obviously going with that next man up mentality. You're going to have guys that are not playing in one of the games, most likely, especially your catcher. Your pitching staff has to be relatively deep to get through it, or you need good outings from starters. And good outings from starters doesn't happen all that often, so you need to have depth and make sure that you're.
I feel like half those doubleheader games, they went opener.
Yeah, no, they did. I think Chad Green was definitely involved in a lot of them. But the it does. It speaks to the depth of this team. It really does, and just proves how relentless they are. Doesn't matter, you know, when it is, where it is, how it is. These guys come at you tenfold, and that's like my biggest positive for about this team. I think that's going to translate later in the season, is that they're deep. I've been saying this all year. You know, when you have that much. When you're battling adversity that much, and you have these guys who are now tested, and they've been playing in major league games for, you know, a long time, and they've gotten a lot more seasoned than you'd ever expect. Well, now you have, you know, you're 2 to 3 deep at different positions, whether you're switching them around or not. You're 2 to 3 deep in different positions where you can you have faith in that guy, and everybody else has faith in that guy.
Man, does depth really matter in the playoffs?
Yeah, I think it does, because things happen. I mean, you know. Things happen. You need big pinch hit spots. Like, how many times do you see like a big pinch hit spot that, or you know, whatever the situation may be, it could be situational baseball where someone has to get taken out of a game and an injury, whatever it is. Like, it's things happen in the playoffs. No hold barred at that point.
I don't think depth matters nearly as much in the playoffs. As
I mean, certainly season. Oh yeah, certainly it's more the regular season, but it also helps you in the dog days of the regular season. And allows you to keep, you know, your number one guys fresh.
Yeah, it can set you up for October. Depth can set you up for October. It can win you home field advantage because you're not going to lose games you shouldn't lose. It's like you said, it's going to keep your guys fresh. It can battle you through injuries, which the depth has really done all season for the Yankees. So yeah, I agree with that. But when it's
you also have the ability to match up better too, because you have more options, and that's a good thing.
Yeah,
having the ability to match up with guys, because right now there's no. I mean, if you look around, like if we get a first baseman back and healthy for the playoffs, you know there could be there's definitely a decision to be made, whether it's the DH spot, whether it's and third base. You know, where's LeMahieu going? What's Urshela doing?
Well, that's the thing. LeMahieu's playing no matter what, so it's just a matter of where is LeMahieu playing.
And at this point, isn't Urshela playing?
Well, then if that's the case, then it would have to be LeMahieu at first base. And if Voit or Encarnacion is healthy, I don't think that's the case. I think LeMahieu is then playing third base and Urshela is on the bench.
There's a DH got to be there too. But look, that's what's crazy. Urshela is among the leaders for the batting title.
No, he's just barely below the qualifying plate appearance for batting title.
How do you sit that guy? You can't. He's a you know, world class third baseman.
That's
the thing. Like, the depth is going to give you more options.
I'll give you another baseball cliche. It will figure itself out. It always figures itself out, whether it's someone slumping, another guy injured, or something. It will figure itself out. And I know we'll talk about it over the next month and a half up until the playoffs. At this point, that's all anyone really cares about is the playoffs. I mean, maybe you're looking towards Houston and what they're doing because you're trying to get home field advantage, which we briefly mentioned last episode. Yankees are 2.5 games up on Houston right now. One interesting thing, though, Houston has the tiebreaker against the Yankees. They have the season series 1-4-3, so the Yankees would actually need to finish a game up on Houston to win home field advantage. Gerrit Cole was scratched from his start with hamstring discomfort. I have not seen an update yet on how long he will be sidelined, if he will be sidelined at all with that injury. But one of those starting pitchers goes down for Houston, and it is a completely different vibe going into a Houston series.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously their big three is what's the scary thing when you see them. And then, but again, they also have some depth.
Starting pitching depth, but that when you're talking about facing Aaron Sanchez or Wade Miley in a game 4, you're like, okay, I think we can somehow figure that game out. But if you're facing him in a game 3 and you only got to go through one of the big three or two of the big three, I think you feel a little bit better about that.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about it. That's a big deal. But you know, we don't know what this is at this point.
It's far away.
Something that's
It's far away.
You know damn well they're gonna treat this thing with kid gloves.
And also,
because I don't think they matter. Well, I mean, they're gonna play for home field. There's no doubt. But if they have their big three, that's more important to them, I think.
Yeah, and it's very close because of I think the 2017 ALCS is a good indicator of how well each of those teams play at home and how good they feel in their own ballpark.
Yep, absolutely. If I see another Altuve home run to left field, I'm going to go crazy.
And so for the Yankees, I it's a balancing act, like we said last week. I don't know what I think they're going to get more guys. They're going to get more guys back to even, I think, win a series against Houston. And if Severino can come back and be almost Luis Severino, then you feel better about that series anyway, because you got some more starting pitching to match up with the Houston starting pitchers.
What we're seeing is something that we've also been talking about getting quality arms. And like this was kind of the narrative for the trade deadline too, about Cashman. Maybe he doesn't go out for the starting pitcher, you know, that we were all expecting him to get, but potentially add, you know, some quality arms at some point. He didn't do any of that. But when you're looking at the guys coming back, the Johnny Lasagna's of the world, like now what we know now is that he is going to be working out of the bullpen and stretched out to 3 to 4 innings. And that's what you're looking at. Like, you know, one guy we haven't talked about in a couple episodes is Davey Garcia. Like, he's definitely been improving in AAA. You're seeing a progression from him. And it's clear that they would, if he were to come up, probably in the September call-ups, that he would be an option out of the bullpen. And they'd still want to see more progression, obviously, from him around the strike zone. But you're seeing more of these guys now who are lining up as 3 to 4 inning guys. And it just gives Boone, you know, a myriad of options to do whatever he wants to in the bullpen. Because now he's got guys that can go, you know, almost as long as a starter. It's because it's really not that far off if you are stretched out as far as 4 innings and actually use all of those bullets up, you know, those are pretty good options. And Severino's looking like that. Lasagna's looking like that. You know, again, potentially a David Garcia later. We're seeing more and more of these guys, and who knows what the hell Herman is at that point.
Yeah. So Herman, that's a good segue. It's an interesting point. So in the Tuesday game, they went with a 2-man bench and a 10-man bullpen. I don't expect them to quite do that in October, because that would be really setting yourself up for disaster if one of your guys, your position players, goes down. But I think we're going to see a loaded bullpen in the playoffs. And like you said, just get a couple innings out of guys here and there. Somehow try and compile 27 outs a night.
Yeah. You know, that's the whole thing about everybody talking about the opener. I think we're going to see a structure that's going to look like an opener situation, but they're going to be starting pitchers in the beginning. And if there's any sign of trouble, or if there is some sign of trouble, or if, you know, whatever it may be, then they're going to have Boone's going to feel comfortable with the guys that are behind them. You know, we saw in 17 in the wild card with David Robertson coming in for Severino and, you know, being that guy. Well, I think there's multiple guys like that now that I think at least they're building up to be like that for the playoffs, that Boone can feel comfortable with. And that they're hoping, they have, you know, a few of them. Like Garcia would be a great. I'm really looking forward to that kid. I really hope that he gets the call up so that we can just at least see what it is.
The David Robertson type, Conrad Milhaupt wrote a really good article on the website earlier this week talking about the pitching staff top to bottom in the playoffs. And he used a bunch of different metrics, but one of them was leverage and the leverage index and who Boone should go to in the most high leverage situations. Other than Chapman, who's obviously the closer, Tommy Canley has actually been the most effective in the most high leverage situations. So we could see Tommy Canley being deployed sort of like what Chad Green was deployed, Robertson was deployed in the 2017 playoffs, where if shit hits the fan in the second inning, guess what? It's Tommy Canley time. Doesn't matter that it's the second inning.
Yeah, no, that could be. I think that the fact that he has that wipeout changeup is a big deal for, you know, this fastball hitting league. The fact that he can pull the string on lefties as well. The fact that he's a righty and matches up really well with lefties because of that changeup. He's been good. He just looks like nails. So he's one of those guys you just, after we saw the resurgence of this year, he got rid of the Red Bull, got rid of all the extra crap that he needed. The sugar was too high. It was affecting him. And he came up, you know, as a pissed off Tommy Canley, the bulldog that we originally got from the White Sox. So funny enough, they were in the same trade.
Yeah. So Tuesday night's game. So Tuesday got away from me. A little story, little aside. So I went out for Taco Tuesday because LeBron James told me to. And
LeBron's really affecting the world. My son had tacos on Tuesday, and I'm pretty sure my wife has no idea what Taco Tuesday is with LeBron.
Yeah.
She just heard it through somewhere else, I'm sure.
Yeah, probably. It reached mainstream media, so. But so we went out for to this taco place by me, and there's a comedy club underneath the taco place. And I was there with a couple friends, and the outside of the restaurant, there's also the sign for the comedy club, and they're advertising Jeremy Piven as the guy.
Ooh.
And I'm like, Jeremy Piven's a stand-up comedian now? Like, I have no desire.
He started as a stand-up comedian, I think.
Okay, well, he's having a nervous breakdown because he was dressed like an emo version of Indiana Jones. It was really bizarre. He was terrible. That's not the point of the story. The manager was walking around the restaurant trying to get people to come into the comedy club. This is a Tuesday night. Like, I had no plans to go see Jeremy Piven. But the manager, she was like, Jeremy Piven's performing tonight. I'm like, yeah, whatever. Bill Burr's making a special appearance. So, because Bill Burr's, I guess he's in town for the summer doing a movie, and he's just trying
I think they're friends.
Piven and Burr?
I think so. Right, when they go back, I think it goes back to that original comedy circuit.
Okay, maybe that's the case. But I was like, well, I got to go see Bill Burr. I'm a huge Bill Burr fan. And all it was a one drink minimum if you were eating dinner at the restaurant. So I saw Bill Burr do 20 minutes for a one beer, what cost of one beer. But I was planning on watching the Yankees game. Instead, I went and watched Bill Burr. That's my side story. And I had to watch.
That's a good stumble. That's one of the beauties of living in New York, and you can stumble across one of those things.
Right.
Because that happens a lot. It's just you have to be in the right time at the right place. You can't plan it.
Right. And
so that's a good story. I like that.
And if I was going to miss one game, it's going to be a Tuesday game against the Baltimore Orioles.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it.
But
that's a go. I'm surprised Jeremy Piven was bad, though.
Yeah, he.
I like him from like early on stuff too, like PCU. Like I call myself a Jeremy Piven fan.
He's funny in movies and shows, but he's just not a good stand-up comedian. Maybe it almost seemed like he was doing shtick, and like he's trying to make a point or something. Very very weird, very self-deprecating, which can be funny. It was just kind of sad.
Okay. You know, and a lot of these guys test out material in places like
oh sure show, there so. Was like 30 people in the audience.
Yeah, so he was, what was the name of the club, do you remember?
West Side Comedy Club.
Okay. He yeah, so he may have been testing out some stuff.
Yeah,
interesting. That's cool.
So I went back and watched the condensed game and everything on this Tuesday game, and Herman's start, where he goes 7 innings, and we've talked about this innings limit so much. If there is really an innings limit and they have a plan mapped out for this guy, why are they allowing him to go 7 innings against the Orioles when you have a big lead anyway?
First of all, I heard Boone talking about this as well, and there have been no, from what they're saying, again, and take this with a grain of salt because I don't believe 95% of the things that come out of anybody's mouth, but they haven't had the ultimate discussions about the limits.
That's obviously bullshit.
This is what they're saying, but why would they say that? Why would they say that out in the public? That's just a strange thing to say. This start, I was definitely surprised to see him back out, especially the way that the game was going. But man, it was an easy 7 innings.
Of course it was.
Man, it was an
easy.
No innings limit. It felt like an easy 93 pitches.
Listen,
for him.
If there's no innings limit, I got no problem setting him back out there for 7 innings. I love to get 7 innings out of my starting pitcher. Build his confidence. Let him go deep in games. That is exactly what I want to see out of my starting pitching. But if you are going to be shutting him down or limiting his innings at one point, that is an easy place to just save an inning or two.
Yeah.
You got a 10-man bullpen. You have a 10-man bullpen for a reason.
Right.
Trot them out.
And it's the Orioles.
Right.
You know, it's a valid point. And again, it depends on what they're doing, what the plan is. And I don't think any of us know. We're all speculating on what the plan is for Herman, because he is going to be up against these the innings and the pitches, you know, with the highest in his career, and we don't know how he's going to react. I want them to listen to the player. I want them to watch it. I want them to do the right thing. But what that right thing, again, like we said last show, like there's no win for them unless he pitches throughout the year and then pitches in the playoffs and does well. Like that's the only time that they can win. Everything else is a loss for them because there will be something blamed.
And
it's a tough spot for them. It really is.
Yeah. And I think we're starting to see, I think we're going to
get... Because he looked damn good, too. He looked damn good.
Yeah, just the two solo home runs allowed, 93 pitches in seven innings is pretty efficient, especially for today. So I'm looking up his career high. I forget his career high. 123 and a third innings is his career high in innings pitched. That is in 2014. That was in single A ball. He's at 116 right now. So he's basically up against his career high. But think about it. 2014 is a long time ago.
Right.
Last year, he threw like high 80s in innings. 80, it was 89 innings combined last season. So, I don't know. Are they going off the 89 number on an increase? Are they going off the 123 number on an increase? I think they have something in mind. And
I'm sure they have something in mind, but maybe they don't have a number that they're going off of. They're looking more at what the player is doing today.
Yeah, yeah. And
because this is one of those things, right? Like there's no perfect algorithm for this. There's no perfect recipe. We've seen it work. We've seen it not work. It's just, you know, whether you throw him and he gets tired. Okay, you can't really predict that. Whether you shut him down and he doesn't come back, I think what the thing that we said last show, which I think to me makes the most sense, is we have seen Domingo Germán, even though he says that he doesn't want to do it this way, we have seen him be shut down for injury or whatnot and then come back and be successful. So he's proved that he can do it, and he's done it this season. So what's there to say that why can't you shut him down at a certain point then and then ramp him back up in a similar fashion like you did for the injury? And then expect his body to do something similar because we've seen it now happen. Even though he says that's not what he wants to do.
Well, what we're seeing now is because CeCe's returning this weekend, CeCe's going to get the start on Sunday. That would be Herman's day to start on 5 days rest. But Herman's going to get pushed Monday off day. He's probably going to start Tuesday in Oakland on the road trip. They haven't announced that yet, but that would be a few extra days rest for him. And if they start doing that, I think you can limit his innings that way. Because you have CeCe. So now you have, with an opener, six starting pitchers. I could see them doing that for the rest of the season, or at least
I mean, that's assuming health with CeCe.
That's a big assumption. But yeah. I could see them doing that for at least the next couple weeks while CeCe is, we're trying to figure out if he's healthy or not. While they're going to get September call ups coming, and you have more pitchers that you can go to.
How many more cortisone shots does CeCe get? Even though the doctors are like, no more. He's like, just hit me.
Yeah, I don't think.
He's like, just hit me.
I mean, come on. This is CeCe's last year. He is not thinking past the end of October. That's just all he is concerned about.
And, just hit me.
But you know what?
I don't know.
Does CeCe, how much is CeCe going to care if he's not pitching in October? Like, obviously he wants to pitch, but he's probably not going to pitch in October. So he's just going to be in the dugout. He's going to be with the guys. He's going to be yelling. If there's a brawl, if there's anything, he's the first guy.
I have a very difficult time. I have a very difficult time seeing them leave CeCe Sabathia off of the playoff roster.
I mean, it all depends on how he comes back and if he's...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a huge, huge question mark with his health. That's the biggest thing. There's no doubt.
If he comes back and struggles or he's got more knee issues, you can't put him on the roster. That would be a wasted roster spot. That means you're essentially going with 24 people and you're handcuffing yourself for no reason.
But if he shows that he's healthy and I would have a very difficult time seeing them leave him off.
And if all things are equal between him and Jay Happ, they're going to go with CeCe.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know if you're going to have Sabathia and Happ on a 25-man playoff roster.
Well, I mean, it depends. It depends because they're going to be taking some of the spots of some of the bullpen guys. That's the thing. Like some of the Luis Sessas of the world. And depending on how they're going to go with the bench, if they do go with a... They can't really go with a totally short bench.
No, you've got to add extra guys for extra inning situations, for pinch running. If a guy gets banged up, you need to have...
But you also need to have guys in there for depth as far as pitching. So, yeah, it'll be interesting how that plays out to see which guys are stretched out, which guys are healthy, which guys are pitching well. Because there's definitely a battle right now. Like, all these guys are battling for probably two more bullpen spots that are going to be available from either the starters or some of these guys that are coming back.
Right, it might not even be available. If Severino and Betances come back, then those two spots might just be those guys.
Right.
Right. So, with the whole innings thing on Germán, I know they say publicly that there's no formal plan in place. I just don't believe them. I just flat out don't believe them.
I don't either. I think that they've definitely have something, you know, drawn out, or at least they have considerations that they're looking at. But I do think that the fact that we're getting these guys back to, you know, the the four inning starters, because that's kind of what they are. These, we have a, I feel like we're getting three or four inning pitchers, and those are the guys that are going to help, you know, eat the innings of some of where the starters would be. And it does allow you, I mean, they may even go, if this opener thing is working, I could see them later in the season using it a couple, you know, to give another guy a day off. If the bullpen's rested and they have a Severino or a Johnny Lasagna, you can go out there and throw four innings. Like, it wouldn't surprise me for them, one of them to get a start, and you skip a Herman. So I think it's going to be super flexible. I think it's a fluid situation, and I think they kind of like that. I think they like that they have options. Again, speaking to the depth, it's going to set them up for what they need to be in October, and that's healthy and firing on all cylinders. So you have them, again, it's so many options now to make sure that you're going in with your best foot forward. It's a good thing. It's a damn good thing.
One of the pitchers, too, I think is starting to round into form, and I'm very excited about Paxton and what he's done over his last few starts. And to shout out another article on the website, Rohan Arcot wrote a really good article about the evolution of Paxton's pitch mix and what he's done to sort of reinvent himself in the middle of the season. So he's decreased his four-seam fastball usage from 60% down to about 50%. He's decreased his cutter percentage. He's increased his curve percentage, and he's also added in a changeup, which he threw 9 times against the Orioles on Monday. It's a new pitch for him pretty much entirely. And what we're seeing is he's more focused on throwing different speeds because his fastball and his cutter were very similar in speed. He's talked about this, Paxton. There were some quotes in Rohan's article. A batter can gear up for 88 to 95 miles an hour, and it's they can adjust to 88 to 95 miles an hour. But if you can also throw either a changeup and a curveball in the low 80s, that adds a totally new dynamic to what the hitter has to prepare for. And Paxton's fastball is still his best pitch, but 60% of the time, eventually hitters are going to just start squaring it up. They're going to start sitting on it. They're going to start hitting it, especially if you miss spots on it. You've got to be almost perfect if you're going to throw 60% fastballs. And we saw him be imperfect with location far too often this year and get beat.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the problem with him. Like, that was the biggest problem, I think, that moved to this mix. I think it's a really good thing for his career, honestly. The fact that he had those struggles and now is able to, add this changeup and, bring in these the off-speed stuff a lot more. I think it's just going to make him more of a dangerous pitcher because when he's in Seattle, we're seeing injuries. We're seeing a guy that looked really good, flashed at 98, like throwing high 90s. We're all like, yes, this is awesome. He's like that prototypical. I know you were getting all like giddy and excited about a guy that kind of fits the big lefty ace.
Yeah, hell yeah.
The guy that we've all been wanting, the Bumgarner type. Granted, we haven't seen the big games from him, but like, he fits that bill as far as physically. And
how does that not get you excited?
I know, I agree. But the fact now is that he's, and I think this is a lot of the Larry Rothschild effect. People don't want to give him credit, but everything you hear from everybody in the booth and everybody about Larry Rothschild is that he's one of the hardest working guys, like does everything possible for you. I think this is to his credit, where he's trying to get the timing changed on a batter. And especially because Paxton wasn't locating that fastball, you got to show something different, because now that you're throwing at 60% and you're not locating it, well, people can just sit on that. And now it's leaking over the plate, so we got problems.
Well, it's actually interesting. You say it's the Larry Rothschild effect. I'm not saying he has no impact on this, but we're now starting to see more of a mix of what we saw last year in Seattle, where around half of the time he was throwing four-seam fastball. He was basically four-seam fastball curveball in Seattle. Those were his two go-to pitches. The biggest difference for him this year with the Yankees was he was like four-seam fastball cutter were his two pitches. So he's decreased. What we've seen is really a de-emphasis on the cutter and more of an emphasis on the curveball in the last few starts, and it's been working for him. Yeah, maybe that's the Larry Rothschild effect.
It's more of an emphasis on the hard. It's more of an emphasis on the soft stuff compared to the hard stuff, and that's, yes, Larry Rothschild.
Yeah,
that's his MO.
And it's not all perfect. It's not all rainbows and unicorns for James Paxton, because he still gave up a run in the first inning, which means he's now given up 25 earned runs in 21 innings pitched in the first inning this year. It's a 10.71 ERA. This is something. If these sort of problems happen in the playoffs, could be the difference in a ball game.
Yeah, and it'll also be the difference in the he's got to show that he can get through for the beginning innings, because there's a confidence meter too with your starting pitching, and when you get into the playoffs, that meter gets, you know, lower and lower and lower as far as the when you're making that change. And if you're getting into trouble early, there could be a time where, you know, if it's a pivotal game, that Boone's going to go to the bullpen on, you know, one of the first signs of trouble. And then depending on what that is, like, that could really hurt the team and the way that the bullpen is used and them deploying some of their big guns. So a lot of it is, it's important for him to get off to these good starts, because it seems like when he does get into, when he gets into the flow of a game, when he gets into the flow of his pitch, it's like the guy is really good at that point. And, you know, he still makes a couple of mistakes here and there, but I mean, you see the James Paxton that we all thought we were getting.
You just alluded to this, but okay. So Paxton is going in game one or two in the playoffs of the division series, and he gives up a run in the first inning, and there's a couple guys on base. Well, you're not just sitting back in the dugout folding your arms saying, well, let him get through it. You got to call down to the bullpen and get someone warmed up. It's a completely different urgency in the playoffs that can unravel so quickly with just a couple things going wrong in the first inning.
Absolutely. There's no doubt. And again, if you get into trouble in the first inning, and even if you get out of it, now it's in the back of your mind where if you get into trouble, like you said, they're going to get someone up. Those B-whips are coming into play. These guys are throwing the pitchers in the bullpen, and you got someone breathing down your neck. And whether, you know, James Paxton gets affected by that, but again, it's going to be a much quicker trigger in the playoffs. So he's got to prove that he can get through these first innings, because they know. The unfortunate thing is they know he settles into games.
But a lot of times you just can't wait.
You can't get snake bit.
Yeah. You starting to get worried about Aaron Judge's slump? It's ongoing.
I'm not, no.
So a couple rundown on his numbers here. He's 12 for 76. It's a 158 batting average with, over the course of this slump, these are actually the more concerning things. Sub 300 on base percentage and sub 300 slugging percentage.
I'm seeing him chasing pitches. This guy looks uncomfortable.
In the span of his slump, his batting average has dropped from 311 to 263, and his OPS has dropped from 984 to 842. I know he's getting a lot of bad strike calls on him, low strikes. We've seen it happen. Seems like more frequently over the last couple months, but maybe that's just because we're noticing them because he's not hitting otherwise. But a lot of people are managing and evaluating from their couches and on Twitter saying this guy does not look healthy. Still has not pulled a home run. He's not pulling the ball with power. He's not hitting the ball in the air.
He smoked the ball to left field the other day.
No, that was off the end of the bat.
It doesn't matter if it's off the end of the bat or not. Still, you can still hit the ball hard. You can still swing hard.
Yes. Okay.
The hell does that have to do
with it? Squirrel can find a nut. You're not worried at all that Aaron Judge doesn't look right?
No, I'm not worried. I maintain a steady hand throughout a baseball season. And what I'm seeing is a guy that is definitely struggling at the plate. There's no doubt. He's got some level of uncomfortableness. He's chasing pitches that he doesn't chase. Like he struck out yesterday in a high fastball that was just, you could see the frustration in his face. Like, why is he chasing it? So I think he's pressing. I definitely think he's pressing. And when Aaron Judge presses, everything becomes that much worse with his mechanics, because he's such a big guy and it's so hard to repeat those mechanics. When he's out of it, it takes a lot more for him to get back into it. And when you're swinging at bad pitches and your head's not in there, it becomes a mental game at that point. So I think at some point he's going to get back to his mechanics. He's going to find that zone where he feels good. He's going to start seeing the ball better, and he's going to be okay, because he doesn't. I don't see him. Why do people say he's unhealthy? Because of what they're seeing. Because he's not pulling the ball to left field. Mm-hmm. He's still hitting the ball hard. I'm still seeing
the exit velocity balls getting hit hard. It's the exit velocity is there. It's the launch angle that's not there for him. And I don't know. Could that be something with the oblique injury? Because listen, that was that weird quote after the oblique injury back in like April or May, where Judge said it's probably not going to be 100% this year.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I see a guy that, and maybe the oblique injury got him into some bad mechanical issues as well. But I'm just not at a point where I'm worried about it yet. I think that there's still plenty of time left in the season for him to get right, because I don't think he's unhealthy. I think that he's a guy that's just battling up there trying to find his right zone. He hasn't found it yet. What this means is that the league is in big trouble because Aaron Judge hasn't found it yet. The rest of the team has. Aaron Judge, I think, hit, what, 2 home runs against the Orioles? And everybody else hit 97 home runs. And when you see that Aaron Judge is the guy that's not leading your team in home runs against the Orioles, but Gleyber Torres and Sanchez, who's been hurt, you know, that means that good things are going to happen from him, unless there is an injury.
Well,
from what I'm seeing, I don't see an injured guy.
If there's an injury, the Yankees obviously don't know about it because I really don't think they would have him playing through it, especially with a huge division lead. I think.
And you don't think they know about an injury with Aaron Judge?
No. What I'm saying is if there was an injury. So what I'm saying is there's no injury.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying. Because they would not let Aaron Judge play through injury with this big of a division lead. If they're in a dogfight and everyone else is injured, maybe they say, okay, Aaron Judge wants to suck it up. He's going to suck it up. But if he is in the trainer's office getting treatment on his oblique and the Yankees have a huge division lead, they buried Boston, Tampa is all but buried, and Aaron Judge is slumping 158 batting average over his last month of play pretty much, they would be like, dude, we're shutting you down. It's okay. Get healthy.
If he was injured, yes, that's exactly what would happen. They would not. They're going to handle him with kid gloves. They've proved that in the past. They handle him with. He's different. They treat him differently.
Unless
what? He's not saying something? Like he's too big of a freaking guy.
Who would get called up if Aaron Judge goes on the IL?
If he goes on the IL, oh, well, I don't know. Clint Frazier can't play right field.
Exactly. So. Maybe they're like, dude, you got to play through injury because we don't have another right fielder.
Yeah, but wouldn't that be a really good opportunity for him to get some reps when your team is up?
No, the Yankees hate Clint Frazier.
He can rake.
There's an interesting stat somebody tweeted me at Alex Fuiz. I'll just cut to the point here. In wins, Aaron Judge has a 988 OPS, and in losses, he has a 618 OPS. So still sort of where Aaron Judge goes, the Yankees go sort of thing.
I mean, yeah. But the thing is, they're still winning games.
Right.
They're winning a ton of games, even with him not playing to his peak. So there's other guys that are stepping up. And again, this is what I'm hanging my hat on.
I'm hanging. Depth. So I look, I use my eyes. I watch these games and I say, he does not look healthy. I'm not saying he is not healthy, but he doesn't look healthy. He doesn't look like just Aaron Judge. Doesn't look like Aaron Judge.
Because he's not mashing the ball. That's why. When he's in a slump, he doesn't look like Aaron Judge. He's still playing the ball well. He's still playing defense well. He's diving all over the place.
I see him doing things that are uncharacteristic of Aaron Judge.
Chasing balls. He's getting back into old habits that really were one of the big struggles for him in the beginning. Again, when you have a guy that's that big and you fall into some bad mechanical issues, it's not easy to get back into them. It's not. It's just. It takes a lot more work, I think, for these bigger body guys to get back into their right muscle memory place and their right zone. Because if they're off even just a little bit, it just makes that much more of a difference with their swing and the way that they're going. So, you know, maybe he needs a little visit from his hitting coach. Maybe he needs a little visit on that.
Yeah, maybe he should listen to that episode of the Bronx Pinstripe Show where we talk to him and can get some pointers that he might be
forgetting. Oh, dude, like this guy's all over Twitter. I follow him every day and looking at the stuff that he does. Some of the drills that he teaches now are really interesting when you're talking about launch angle, too, with the way that he teaches almost like not an uppercut swing, but
snap.
It's the snap. No, but it's the path in which your abdomen and your chest almost points up to left field when you swing.
Okay.
And I think he's falling out of he wasn't doing that when he first came up.
Oblique could affect where your chest and abdomen are pointing through a swing.
Sure, it could. It also could. It could be a, you know, when you're trying to ramp back up from an oblique injury, it could get you into a bad mechanical problem because you're, you know, maybe concerned about it or whatever. I think this does stem from the oblique injury at some point. But I'm not seeing a guy that's not healthy currently. I just think he fell into some bad stuff.
Injury rundown. So George's Box guys, JJ and Keith, had a really good question on their show where they said, if you could only pick 4 of the injured guys to come back, who would it be? They talked about that on their most recent episode. Go listen to George's Box. But I want to ask you, if you could pick 4 of the guys who are injured to have back at the end of the season, Sabathia, Voit, Encarnacion, Seve, Betances, Hicks, Isaac is already back, so take him out. Stanton, who are you taking? What 4 guys are you taking? They also included Jacoby Ellsbury, but I think that was just for a cheap laugh.
JJ, the cheap laugh. So I'm definitely taking two guys off the bat, which are no-brainers to me. And I think I agree with Keith in this sense. Severino and Betances, number one and number two for me. Those are the two guys that I'm back. I want pitching. The next guy I'm probably taking is Aaron Hicks. I think that when Aaron Hicks is right, he's a difference maker, not only in the field, but he also allows for different things to happen. Because that means if Aaron Hicks isn't there, you're starting somebody in center field, you know, whether it's Talkman. I'd still laugh when I say it.
No, but I mean, Gardner, it's not that, it's not to knock those guys, Maybin or Talkman, but it's being logical about it and saying, how long can this sort of thing last with these guys?
Right.
Eventually, yeah, it's going to stop.
Or you just have to fade.
Or you have to say that if they come back down to earth, who do you trust more? Mike Talkman, who had the season of his life for the first time ever, or Aaron Hicks?
He's had a month and a half of his life.
Still the season of his life.
Yeah. So I'm taking Hicks, and then I'm going with a big bat, and I'll probably take an Encarnacion just because he's got the experience. And so those are my four guys. I want the defender out there, and I want two pitchers, and I want a first baseman.
It's funny that you said those and four guys, because those were the same four guys I picked, because Severino is not an option in this question.
But I would definitely put Betances in there too, because Betances is a difference maker.
Yes, but frankly, I'm still thinking that the only way this team wins a World Series is if Severino comes back and is good. I'm not saying he's got to go 9 innings, 8 innings, 7 innings like we've seen him do in the past, but he needs to be pitching in the playoff starting rotation. I'm using air quotes because whatever that means in the playoffs, he needs to be giving them quality innings in the playoffs.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely one of those when you look up and down the roster and you need one guy to get through with what they're going to have to go through in Houston. If that's the team that they meet in the ALCS, then yes, they need another dominant pitcher, because hopefully James Paxton could be that guy and round out the season and you know, finish strong. Hopefully we could see Tanaka build off of his last start and continue to, you know, progress with that different grip on the splitter and making sure that he's that guy down on the zone, because that's huge. Obviously, we know what he's done in the playoffs in the past, but you need that third guy. If we can have that third guy, then that's essentially huge.
Neither of us said Giancarlo.
No, I mean, at this point, offense is not a problem.
NL MVP, $30 million a year. Yeah. Nah.
And again, it just speaks to the way this team is constructed. They don't need that guy. To me, when you're rounding out the perfect lineup and you're putting together a perfect playoff team, like, I want defense. I want guys who can hit and make a lot of contact, who work the counts. Encarnacion's definitely one of those guys. And I want pitching. I want more pitching. But because the current roster hits, they hit. So
here's a caveat to this. The caveat to the question was they're going to be back and they're going to be fine. Because Encarnacion has a fractured wrist. He might not be fine. He might not have the same power. And if that's the case, maybe I don't want Encarnacion back. Because then it's just a name at that point. And then you're deciding between Luke Voit or Giancarlo Stanton. Who's going to give you better quality at-bats in the playoffs? If both are fully healthy, I guess it's Giancarlo Stanton, right?
It's crazy. You need another first baseman, though. That's the thing. Like, you need a defender out there, because now you're starting LeMahieu at first base every single time.
Yeah, you'd be starting LeMahieu at first base, which is not ideal, because you're sort of just wasting his premium defense at first base.
But you have a premium third baseman. You have a good... It doesn't really hurt much either, though.
I think it certainly
doesn't hurt.
I think it hurts.
It doesn't hurt, because he's a better first baseman than anybody else on the roster.
But first base defensively is less important than second base or third base.
I understand.
And I know you called Gio Urshela a premium third baseman. Every defensive metric says he's not a premium defensive third baseman. And he's not as good of a defensive third baseman as DJ LeMahieu. He's not bad, but he's not premium. I know everyone thinks he's gold glove, because he got the reputation that he's gold glove because he couldn't hit. That is the only reason he got that.
That is not true.
Yes, it is.
It's also because he makes amazing plays and people see the flash.
Okay, fine, fair. He can That's make the reason. Amazing plays. But I talked about this with Dan Zimborski.
But since that interview, I want to see what those metrics look like. We don't have it right here, but let's look those up. Because the metric, I haven't seen many of those like little dumb plays that that I know Sean was keying on.
It's not even errors. I mean, he made a bad play on Sunday, Masahiro Tanaka's game. That the tag, but also the Tanaka game where he didn't get charged with an error, but it was a ground ball to third base and he just bobbled it. Somehow they called it a hit. And it's not just errors, because Matt Chapman for the A's led the league in errors last year, and he was far and away the best defensive third baseman in baseball. So it's not just errors. But
I'm not saying errors. I'm saying, like, you know, just mindless plays, because it seems like his errors are the ones that are where concentration is lapsed almost. It doesn't seem like they're difficult plays.
He
sometimes boots the easy play.
I'm not saying that he is a bad defensive third baseman. I am trying to get to it now. And why is it giving me his left field stats? I don't care about his left field stats. Where are his? Okay.
The thing is when you're looking at
moment. Here we go.
Real quick, when you're looking at the defensive lineup, and I understand that LeMahieu is probably better than everybody at every position possible. Like, I don't care where he goes, he's probably better. And you're sticking him at first base. Like, that's not ideal. I understand that. And you're not using his defensive capabilities to the most because you're putting him at first base. But the point is that he is much better as of a defender than the other first baseman that you have. That I think that there's also a compensation where you do have a third baseman that can come in there and play well. You have a shortstop that doesn't matter because he's going to be there anyway. And then you have Glaber, who's playing a good second base. So it doesn't hurt you that badly to have him at first base.
Gio Urshela, -5 defensive runs saved at third base, -2.5 UZR. So you want to say that defensive metrics are not
that's for the
100%
entire season.
So you want to bump it up a little bit and get him to zero in each of those categories. That means by defensive metrics, he's league average. And I would even say he's better than league average, but he's not premium.
Can you break that down for the last?
They don't have splits.
2 months?
Because again, defensive metrics they normalize the course of time. So 2 months, you're going to get wildly drastic.
I'm just curious as to what his defensive play, because it seems like in the past month and a half that I've seen a guy that hasn't made a lot of those careless errors that he did early in the season. Yeah. And I think that's what's affecting
a lot of
it.
Listen, I still feel comfortable with Urshela at third base, okay?
I feel damn comfortable with him.
That's not what I'm
there.
Saying. But the point is that LeMahieu's best defensive value to the Yankees is not at first base.
I'm not disputing that. I'm not disputing that.
Also on this episode is not over. I talked to Mandy Bell. She is the MLB.com reporter for the Cleveland Indians. The Yankees got a big series this weekend. I'm pumped about this series because I feel like since they destroyed Boston, it really hasn't been much to get excited about as far as opponents to play. But this is a really big test. The Indians are the hottest team in baseball since June 1st. Their potential playoff matchup. They just made a huge trade that actually has worked out in their favor so far. They got reinvigorated with that Bauer/Puig/massive trade. I'm excited about this weekend 4-game series.
Yeah, me too. I like the fact. I mean, the rest of the. If you look at the scheduling in baseball and the fact that they've already played the Baltimore Orioles 19 times, and you see you go around to see like the other teams in the AL East and how many times they've played them, it's crazy. It's pretty wild to see I think Boston has played them under 10 times.
I think it's 12.
What I saw. Somewhere it was around 10. It was significantly less. But the fact that you know they are Cleveland's coming in with a big 4-game set, and then they're going to the dreaded West Coast trip. Like, in all honesty, like, things could be very different in a week and a half.
Yep.
Things could be very different, especially when they're playing the Dodgers, who are right there for best record of baseball with the Yankees. And then Oakland, who's always a pain in the ass when you go out to Oakland. So you have opportunities where the Yankees
Oakland's
could
also a potential playoff mat, like,
absolutely.
Playoff team. So you're playing in the next 2 weeks potentially three teams you could see in October.
Yeah, so it's a big stretch for them. I think it's one of those we're gonna kind of see what they're made of as well. I think the pitching staff is going to be very, very spotlighted. We're gonna really see what these guys have progressed, like we think they have from the trade deadline time. It'll be good. But I like it. And like, give me some competition, please. This Baltimore series was like snooze fest almost. I mean, we're seeing Gleyber Torres headed out. I love that. That's great. It's fun to watch, but goddamn, give me some competition.
They're going to get some competition as far as the Cleveland pitching, because even without Bauer, they're filthy. So the Yankees are going to miss Shane Bieber, who's maybe the Indians' best pitcher, but they're going to see Clevinger, who's been great. They're going to see this new kid, Aaron Civale, who I talked to Mandy about. He's a rookie. He's allowed 2 runs in 18 innings so far as a starter for them. Everyone in the organization, she said, say he is like a Kluber 2.0. Like he has modeled himself after Kluber. He has like followed in his footsteps, and they see a lot of Corey Kluber in this kid, Savali.
I don't like to hear that. That's not good. And that's not good, especially with the trade that they just pulled off. They obviously knew that they had depth in the pitching spots, and that they were able to add, you know, some big power bats and get some good prospects. Like the more you look at that trade, the more you're seeing that Cleveland definitely knew what they had in their cupboards, and they were looking for some injection. Like everybody was so wrong about Cleveland and the way that they were going to trade things. Well, and you could see it.
When
like
you look back to the end of May, they were far back of Minnesota. And it took a really hot run for them to now. They're in first place, or at least they were when I recorded with Mandy.
Did we all expect place. Minnesota to hold on to it? Like I personally didn't. But the when you go back to the offseason, like all the narratives of ownership is trying to save money. They're gonna sell everybody. Like they didn't sell anybody. They didn't sell Trevor Bauer for nothing. They got a lot of very good prospects and a good haul back for Trevor Bauer. And they knew what they had in their system to take the place. So they've done a good job, man.
Yeah. And they fixed their weakness, which they didn't fix in the offseason, which was offense. They fixed that with Puig. They got an offensive injection with Puig, and they're starting pitching, especially if they get a healthy Corey Kluber back, and you're going to face in the playoffs, Clevinger, Shane Bieber, Corey Kluber, and now Savali or one of their other pitchers who are all pretty solid sort of number four starters. It's a tough playoff rotation to go up against. And the Yankees are playing them at I'm actually excited. So this might sound backwards. I am happy the Indians are the hottest team in baseball right now and the Yankees are playing them. Because it's a test. It's sort of like when you just need something to like wake you up in the middle of the season.
Kind of like some Adam Gase smelling salts.
Yeah. Like, oh, let's bump some smelling salts and play the Indians for four games. Let's go, baby. Because
yeah, no, it's I like it.
Give me something competitive in right now in Yankees land.
The stadium is going to be live. It's going to be bumping for this series. There's no doubt. Especially you got like a guy like Puig coming in. He's going to piss people off. He's going to rub people the wrong way. We haven't really seen Puig very often. I mean, I know we've played the Dodgers, but he was in a weird place with the Dodgers when he was there and when they played us. But now that he's, you know, fully injected into this stretch run with the Cleveland Indians, he's going to get under people's skin. He's definitely going to, I think the stadium is going to ride him a little bit. He's going to feed off of that. You know, he's coming in ready to piss people off. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be a fun series.
And he served his suspension to be back for the Yankee series. He served his suspension against Boston in the last three games. He is back tonight, Thursday, against the Yankees.
You know damn well he circled this thing. He's loving this. I mean, like from a distance, I always liked watching him play just because he was exciting and we didn't have to deal with him. You know, and he's a pain in the ass, but we didn't have to deal with him again on that side. But now that he's into this playoff contention, he's going to be a pain in the ass. He's going to piss me off too. I know it. I know he's going to piss me off.
You know what? Good.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it.
Get pissed off at the opponent. That's more fun. Sports are fun that way when you hate the opponent.
Oh, the emotion into it is way more fun.
So stay tuned for the Mandy Bell segment. Last thing I want to talk about quickly. You see this Cashman car story? Cashman's Jeep Wrangler was stolen in the Bronx. I stolen because it just showed up at a body shop. It was towed to a body shop in the Bronx. So I don't really know who stole it. But he was driving it back to Connecticut. The police didn't communicate. Anyway, he got held up at gunpoint. And there was body cam footage that was released yesterday. Did you see this footage of Cashman with his hands on his head, getting pulled over in Connecticut, and the cops? And it's funny because the cop immediately was like, "Oh shit, that's Brian Cashman. Like, we made a mistake." But weird story all around with this Cashman car.
The whole thing is strange. The fact that, and it's not like when you're looking for or footage like this, you're looking for a guy that is. Well, one, when I first heard about it, I was like, oh, okay, this was like in the middle of the night. Like they didn't know who it was. No, it's like broad daylight.
Oh, yeah.
He's still out there. And beyond, when you look at the footage, when you see him, and they know who he is, guns drawn, still hands on the head, still hands up. Like it's still, they're treating him like a regular criminal. And I got to tell you, I love the fact that Brian Cashman drives a Wrangler.
This seems like his fun mess around car.
He's going to the stadium and going home in the Wrangler.
That's true. I love that. Because it was in the Bronx. How did it get stolen in the Bronx but then towed to a body shop?
Was it towed to a body shop or was it just taken to a body shop?
I don't know if it was towed or taken.
Was it towed with a chain, you know, from
it's like
you know, whoever stole
it? Once your car gets stolen, though, do you want to still drive that car? I feel like once your house gets broken into, you treat your treat your house differently. Like, oh, there's something off here. I don't want to live here anymore.
You don't want to live there if your house gets broken into?
My apartment, my first apartment out of college got broken into. And after it got broken into, I mean, we moved because we were in a shitty area. But it was just like a weird vibe living in that place. Like, it's been, every time you leave, you got to make sure all the windows are closed and everything. It's just.
I mean, I guess I'm not throwing away my house if it gets broken into. I can tell you that. I'm not throwing away
my car if
someone steals it.
A 1-year lease on an apartment is different than a 30-year mortgage.
Yeah. No, the fact that he drives a Wrangler, I want to see. I've been looking in the video, and I'm trying to find out if it's an automatic transmission or a manual transmission, because this will tell me a story about the man. But if you're driving,
you don't see the inside of the car. It's 3 minutes.
If you're driving
video,
from the Bronx and you're going to Connecticut and you're dealing with traffic and things like this, you're probably not going to be in a manual transmission. But if that was a manual transmission car, even more respect. Like, does Brian Cashman do the Jeep wave? I used to have a Jeep. That's why.
Did you have a Wrangler?
I respect this. Yeah, I had an old Wrangler. Like, I had an old 98 Wrangler that I stripped the inside, took all the carpet out, like, you know, got it so that it was, I didn't care if it rained on. They're so much fun to drive. They're the most fun cars to drive. I absolutely hated giving it up. I gave it up when, after Kemp was born, because I never drove it. I'm like, it's just sitting in my driveway.
Yeah, you still had it. Yeah.
Yeah, I had it for a while.
You're like, I'm insuring this thing for no reason. I just
never drove it, and like, they're meant to be driven, you know, and like, they're fun to drive. So I felt like it was doing me doing the community and the justice for that bad boy to be sitting in my driveway. So I moved it on, and I mean, I got an old Jeep on purpose because they're fun. They're like Legos. Like, if something goes wrong with it, like, you can probably fix it. And there's parts everywhere. They're just awesome to drive. They're really fun cars, especially if you're not driving a distance and you have them for like just around town. They're awesome.
A funny moment in the video was after the cops went through all the checks, like checked his ID and everything. He's just talking to Cashman. He's like, you know, I didn't want to say Brian Cashman over the radio because it would have just caused like, what the hell are you guys doing sort of thing. So I think he realized it was Brian Cashman very early on and then was just like, okay, I'm going to go through protocol. But he had a gun pointed at him. So, I mean, you got a gun pointed at you, even though you know you're innocent, you're still probably shitting your pants if you're Brian Cashman.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's no doubt. And he's driving a Wrangler. Like, is that really Brian Cashman driving the Wrangler?
Right.
Like, I would have had a lot of doubts.
Like, why isn't he driving a Range Rover?
Why is he not driving something with like tinted windows or something? You know, I think that just speaks to Cashman, man. He's just he's an everyday guy. He's a guy that just goes out there, does his job well.
He's worked up from intern level. Maybe he's had that Wrangler for like 30 years. That's a new Wrangler, but you know what I mean. Maybe he's always had Wranglers.
He's a ninja, man. He's sneaky in broad daylight.
Yeah, he's still pulling off trades. They got what's?
Yeah, I know. It seems like he's making a trade every day.
Ryan Dull, another non-40 man trade
waiver. That got put on the 40 man.
Put on the 40 man. Yeah, because they're just. I mean, the two guys, Mantiply and Lael, that they sort of added to the 40 man just for the doubleheader are now DFA'd and released. So
yeah, it's Brady Lael had a pretty good story though. You could see that guy after the.
I
after
think
the
they're
game,
hoping he clears waivers and then they can. Just
I'm
add
sure
him back
he will.
to the minors, and he might just clear waivers.
I'm sure he will. He's a known quantity too. He's been around the system for a long time, so they know what they got there. Other last thing is the event coming up. That's in on August 31st. We're going to be ordering t-shirts.
Yeah, when's the cutoff? It's coming up.
Well, we're ordering t-shirts probably tomorrow at some point. I'm going to be ordering a bunch of shirts. Not to say that that's the cutoff, but we'll still be selling tickets after that. But if you definitely want to be guaranteed your shirt in the mail, then sign up today, tomorrow, and get your guys involved. But this the deal is $69, and we will be watching in 205 the Yankees take on the Oakland Athletics. Again, like we talked about, it's going to be a fun series. That's going to be a fun game. It's a 1 o'clock game on Saturday. Come sit with us. We got a whole bunch of people coming out there. Looking forward to it.
Good stuff. For Monday's episode, submit your mailbag questions, call the voicemail line. We've got a new intern. Welcome AJ to the team. So we want to get the voicemails and all that stuff popping again. Call in. It's 646-480-0342. It's a huge series against the Indians this weekend. If the Yankees take 3 out of 4 or even sweep, They hit these Indians starting pitching. You're going to feel good about yourself. Call up the voicemail line and scream 30 seconds into the phone. Any last words, Scott?
You hit it, man. Just it's going to be a fun series. It's going to be one of those tests that I think we all kind of want to see at this point. Someone who's not in the AL East, someone that's a good team coming in hot. It's going to be fun. They have a lot of excitement. They have a lot of exciting players that I think people, Yankee fans, kind of respect from a distance and like watching from a distance. So I think it's going to be a very interesting series.
All right, Mandy Bell segment coming up, and we will talk to you Monday. Started with nothing really. I was dreaming, sleeping rarely. Had a different theory, then I started thinking clearly. Can y'all even hear me? But always on call. Can't turn around now, I know we're not far. And I can smell it. Deep down they jealous. That'll never sell us what they used to tell us. Shout out to all the fake fans. Joining me on the podcast now is Mandy Bell. She is the Cleveland Indians reporter for MLB.com. And it's been a very exciting couple months for you, Mandy, and the Indians, because they've been one of the hottest teams in baseball. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what sparked the turnaround? I think I saw a stat that they were 11 and a half games back on June 2nd. And now as we sit here Tuesday, they're in first place.
Yeah, it was June 4th that they were as far as 11 and a half back, and since then they've had just a camaraderie in the clubhouse that they didn't have before. Everything started clicking. June 4th was the day that the team had a meeting that Carlos Carrasco revealed to everybody that he was diagnosed with leukemia. I mean, it could be a very strong coincidence, but since then they've been clicking. I mean, we didn't find out as the media until June 5th, but the day before we kept saying that it just seemed like they were playing with an energy that hadn't been there before, and then we found out that they had heard the news and that day. It just seems strange. It seems like too much of a coincidence that everything started to really relax and everyone started to play on a different level with a different enthusiasm since then. But Jose Ramirez has come alive, and just pieces are starting to fall into place that really were missing in the first 2 months of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've heard stories about when real life events can take over sports. And obviously when someone is diagnosed with leukemia, anything that's going on in a baseball field kind of seems insignificant. So maybe, you know, we've heard these kinds of stories again. It's kind of like a Disney movie, like a team can rally together over something like that.
Big time, and that's what it seemed like. I mean, a lot of the players, after we found out the news, we were talking to them, asking them just the reactions to it and what it's like going through that. And everyone just kept saying sort of the same thing. We're realizing that this is just a game. And playing baseball just shouldn't be taken for granted. We should be enjoying it, and we should be having fun. And that's exactly how it seems like that just turned around for them. Everyone just seemed to be having fun. Everyone just seemed to be very high stress and pressing at the plate and very tense. And that just sort of went away at the beginning of June. And ever since, they've been posting the best record in Major League Baseball. And as of now, sitting atop the AL Central standing. So it's been working for them.
Yeah, and how was Francona through all of that? Because I know he's battled illnesses in his past.
He's been great. He doesn't like to touch on it too much because he just wants to respect Carrasco's privacy. He doesn't want to be someone revealing anything, but he just seems to be handling it so well. The Indians are just listening to Carrasco step by step, allowing him to be in full control of his progression back. I mean, he's been starting to throw some bullpen sessions. He had been throwing bullpens before, but took some time off. He wasn't feeling that great afterwards. I mean, he gets tired so easily because of this diagnosis, and it's just a challenge for his body. So he finally overcame that and started to get back on the rubber again. And Tito just could not hide his smile when he came in to tell the media that he was getting back on the mound. He's just so excited for him. The whole clubhouse just absolutely loves him. So it's cool to see how genuinely excited these guys are just to have him back in the clubhouse around the team.
Was there a sense at all that maybe Cleveland had missed their window? Because they obviously had the World Series, heartbreaking loss, and then the best record in the American League in 2017, get upset by the Yankees, and then early bounce in the 2018 playoffs. And it kind of seemed like things were getting out of control, spiraling at the beginning of this year.
Yeah, I don't know if there was an actual sense of missing their window, but it just something felt different. It felt off. I mean, the Indians haven't been that far back in so long. They haven't really had competition in the division in so long.
Right.
So it was sort of just like a little weird wake-up call, like, okay, we need to get this together type of thing. And I mean, they have. They've gone on this incredible stretch, and they said they just had a series in Minnesota over the weekend, and everyone came out of that series saying, this is fun. Mike Clevenger said, this might sound narcissistic, but ever since I've been up here, we've basically never had competition like this during the regular season. And this is really, really enjoyable to be able to have like a taste of playoff type of games, the atmosphere, all that stuff in August. I mean, they're looking at it like this is a big advantage this year. So they're really, really enjoying it. So there seems to be a little bit of a different vibe. I know this is my first year, but I've talked to a lot of guys that have been around the team for a long time now. Everyone keeps sort of saying the same thing. It's a little bit of a different vibe this year than what they felt in years past.
I think I saw a quote by Tyler Clippard, ex-Yankee, who said, we might not have the most talent, but we're the best team in the game. So is that sort of the vibe they're going with?
100%. That's what it seems like. And I think Clippard said it the best to be able to describe it that way. I was heading into the Minnesota series, and we were asking him about trying to bottle emotions going into that series, trying to look at it like any other game. And he's like, no, we're not even trying to do that. We're excited. We know we're excited, and we're looking forward to this. And then that's when he said, I mean, this is basically, they're young. They're such a young team. There's so much inexperience on the team, but that's what Clippard said. I mean, we might not have the best talent, but we're the best team. And they really do seem to be clicking in the clubhouse. Everyone seems to be really, really getting along, and a lot of guys in there have said that this is the closest that they've been with their team in a few years now. So it seems like a fantastic vibe going on in the clubhouse, and I'm sure that's played an enormous role over the last 2 months.
Yeah, you said something about maybe not having competition in the division, and that's been true recently. And I think Minnesota took everyone by surprise, and I know the Yankees just played Minnesota a few weeks back. I'm sure you saw the highlights of that insane 5-hour game when Aaron Hicks makes the diving catch. But like, what you said about it being a playoff atmosphere in the middle of the summer, I mean, that absolutely what it was for the Yankees, those three games there. And I mean, I have to imagine maybe the Indians just figured they'd cruise to another division title at the beginning of this year. That was sort of the argument in the offseason when they didn't really do much.
Yeah, it was tough. I don't know if they necessarily thought they would cruise as much as they have in the last few seasons. They knew that the Twins were going to be better this year, but you could tell that they didn't. I mean, nobody expected the Twins to be as good as what they are this season.
Oh, you didn't expect them to hit the most home runs in baseball? Weird.
Right, I know. I can't believe I didn't predict that one. It's just nobody expected it to be this dramatic, and the Indians especially. Then, like you said, that's why they didn't do too much this offseason. They made a lot of small deals, but the sending Yan Gomes to D.C. was something that they won, although Jeffrey Rodriguez is still on the injured list right now, but they got a prospect in Daniel Johnson. They've got some good smaller deals, but they didn't trade Trevor Bauer or Corey Kluber in the off season. Like, they kept, rumors were out there, but they held on to it because they were expecting the Twins to be a little bit better, but nothing what they are this year, and caught everybody by surprise. They knew that they were going to struggle offensively. They said that going into the year. Tito kept saying that going into the year, saying we're going to basically rely on our pitching a good bit because our offense is, we know there's going to be some learning curves. There's a lot of young bats in that lineup. Cleveland in April can be a challenge. I mean, they were expecting all of those struggles. They just weren't expecting the competition to be so fierce so early on. So it took them a little bit, but they were able to scratch and claw their way back into the division.
Yeah, and I think what you said about their pitching is going to have to carry them. That'll still be true in the playoffs, but that's why I was pretty shocked they ended up trading Bauer. I want to talk about him for a little bit because obviously he was linked to the Yankees a little bit, but was it his antics that actually ended up getting him traded? Not just the throwing the ball over the center field fence, but just everything that comes along with Trevor Bauer?
No, not necessarily. I mean, the Indians president of baseball operations, Chris Antonetti, spoke to the media after the trade happened. And of course he was asked about that. And he said that there was no different conversations because of that. That did not influence their trade. I honestly believe it. I know that they were looking to trade Bauer, obviously, to be able to get some offensive help. It's a sort of a strange concept, trading away one of your best pitchers to sort of get better as a whole. It just seems really, really odd that that's even possible. But they're so deep in starting pitching. They've had so many injuries this year, and each person they've called on from the minor leagues has done more than just patch a hole. They've actually thrived, and it's been really impressive. Guys like Zach Plesac, Aaron Savali, all these guys keep coming up and just really impressing. So when you have that depth in the minor league system that you can just sort of keep rotating guys in the big league rotation, and allowed them to breathe a little bit, trade Trevor Bauer and get guys like Yasiel Puig and Franmil Reyes to be able to add some pop in the lineup. Because if they didn't have that, it's a tough to make a postseason run with Jason Kipnis in the cleanup spot. so they definitely were able to get better as a whole. And it just, I think it was more of a strategy thing rather than Bauer's antics that moved him along. But Francona did say he was a little concerned on what that move in Kansas City, when he chucked the ball over the center field fence, what that would have done to the clubhouse long term.
Yeah, that was his last start, right, as an Indian?
Yep.
Yeah, so that's a tough lasting memory as you're headed out of Cleveland. But what was it like covering Bauer? Because he's an interesting guy. Me and my co-host Scott have talked about on the podcast that we would have loved to see him come to the Yankees, even though the New York media can be harder than any other media market. But sometimes I wouldn't necessarily call Trevor Bauer soft. I'd call him a little crazy, and I think crazy can play in a tough media market. What was it like covering him every day?
He's a very, very interesting person. He's one of the smartest people I've ever talked to. He thinks in ways that I could never have imagined thinking. I mean, he's fascinating to talk to, because you could just sit there, you could ask him one question and he'd give you a 14-minute response and just hit every possible angle of whatever you're trying to get at, and break it down in ways that you just couldn't even ever imagine. He's super interesting to talk to, honestly. I really, really enjoyed covering him. I know he obviously had his antics and he made things a little bit interesting from time to time, whether it was his drones or throwing the ball over the center field fence, whatever it may be.
I'll never forget him bleeding on the mound in the World Series. Like, how do you get that out of your mind? And as a player, as a teammate of his, I'd be pissed, being like, yo, dude, we're in the World Series. Stop playing with drones.
Right. And I mean, he's embraced that as much as possible. I mean, they had a campaign to get Carlos Santana in the All-Star game, and the Indians were going around getting guys to say messages to get fans to vote. And he said, I think his was something along the lines of, you better vote for Los or my drone's coming for your pinky finger. I mean, he's embraced that. And I'm sure there was frustration. I wasn't there that year, but I'm sure there was frustration in the clubhouse during that extremely important time, and to have something, a freak injury like that pop up. But he came with some interesting storylines. There was never a dull moment, but he was really, really interesting. Honestly, he was fascinating to talk to, and I enjoyed covering him.
Do you know who Mike Francesa is? He does local radio in New York. Yeah. Well, then I'm sure you saw he got into a back and forth with Bauer on Twitter. And, you know, people have different opinions of Francesa. But, I mean, that sort of was the worst fear, that if the Yankees did trade for Trevor Bauer, that's what would happen. He would fight back against the media, which will say stuff like Mike Francesa said, that he's a clown. And so what do you think it would have been, if you want to theorize a little bit, if he had come to New York, or if he does come to New York in the future, how do you think that relationship would go?
It'll be interesting to see how he would adjust, right? At least at this point, he struggles to allow those things to just go by without commenting. And obviously in bigger markets, more of those types of headlines are popping up left and right, rather than in smaller markets like Cleveland. And now Cincinnati. And I don't know if he would be able to control himself and not bite every single time he sees something like that on social media. I'm not sure. I wouldn't be surprised if he was very, very vocal. I think it would have been interesting if he would have gone to New York. I know there was a lot of sayings around Cleveland that the Indians didn't have any interest in shipping him off to a potential contender that they could face in the postseason. So that was a big downside of shipping him over to the Yankees. But I don't know. It would have been really, really interesting. I could see him getting into some feuds and struggling to hold himself back to not say some things on social media.
Yeah, we've seen it happen to players in New York in the past, and it hasn't worked out for them. And then other guys come over here and they thrive. So, you never know. But I want to talk about the pitching staff. So Corey Kluber struggled when he was on the mound this year, but he's not been healthy. He's been one of the best pitchers in baseball, obviously, for 5 years. I think he's had 5 top 10 Cy Young finishes prior to this year. What are they expecting him to be if and when he comes back?
It's really hard to place those expectations. I mean, now today, as of Tuesday, he's making his second rehab start in Double-A Akron tonight. They're just sort of listening to him the same way that they're doing with Carrasco. They're trying to make sure that he takes every day that he needs to get back to full strength before rushing him back up to the big league club. But it's hard to put too many expectations on him. He'll likely be back at the end of the month. So as long as there's no setbacks in this little stretch here, I think he should be pretty clear to come back toward the end of August, maybe that final week. But I don't know. I mean, even Kluber himself, he was saying he obviously didn't get off to the start that he would like to this year. And being out for so long while you're trying to build yourself back up from a fractured forearm to try to go from that to getting back up and being better than what you were to start the year, it's a challenge, and everybody knows it's a challenge. So the Indians obviously miss him in the rotation, and they're looking forward to getting him back. But it's going to be waiting and seeing what he has left and how he responds to his injury and throughout his rehab to see how he can impact the team whenever he gets back.
Yeah, and I think on paper anyway, if he can come back and be good, that rotation is extremely scary in a postseason where if you're going to face Bieber, Kluber, Clevinger, and then this new guy, Aaron Civale, am I saying that right?
Civale, yep.
Civale? I mean, 2 runs in 18 innings to start his career is pretty ridiculous.
Both he and Zach Plesac have just shocked everybody. Whenever you think of a year that it was supposed to be a Corey Kluber, Trevor Bauer, Carlos Carrasco, Mike Clevinger, Shane Bieber rotation, and 4 of those guys have either been on the injured list or now traded, it's hard to think that with Shane Bieber being the only one to make every single one of his starts that they have been able to make this run. But Zach Plesac and Yeffrey Rodriguez, who's now on the injured list, and Aaron Civale, all these guys have just been so impressive. Civale, Plesac, and Bieber were all in the 2016 draft class for the Indians, and man, they did well in that one. I mean, the pitching depth that they have is unbelievable. Civale has come up here, and he's not an emotional guy. He's a very, very quiet, only says a few words after every one of his starts, but I think he sort of reminds everybody of Kluber with his two-seamer, with his actions, the way he's so stoic on the mound and even in the clubhouse afterwards. Whenever you're starting to get comparisons to Corey Kluber, I think you're in pretty good company.
Yes, they've definitely been able to develop pitching. I mean, just like you said, the track record of all these pitchers and the depth that they have. And it seems like the trade worked out really well because they got exactly what they wanted, which is outfield offense. And Puig has been good since he came over. I know he's serving he's doing a suspension now, right?
Yes, he'll be out for the Boston series at home, but he will be rejoining the team in New York for the Yankee series.
What was the reaction, I guess, amongst you and your peers? Because Puig can also be an interesting guy to cover when you heard the news.
I was excited, honestly. I've heard so many stories about him that I wanted to see him for myself. And my goodness, he's certainly lived up to the hype. He is one of the most energetic people that I've ever been around. He's so comical. The vibe in the clubhouse is so different now than what it was a month ago before he got there. It's so loud. They're all screaming, yelling, laughing. He and Francisco Lindor and Fran Mel Reyes and Jose Ramirez, like, those four seem to be so tight right now. They're all joking. Roberto Perez, Tyler Naquin, and Yasiel Puig seem to have a good bond going right now. They sit around the table. They eat dinner together every single night after the games, and they just are joking all the time. And he's running around the clubhouse. He seems to be the center of every joke. It's a different clubhouse than the calm, cool, collected one a month ago. This is lively, energetic, and we got to talk to him the other night, and he's sitting there telling us about how he would chase chickens growing up and race horses in the streets. And I mean, things that you never would think would ever come up in an interview, but Yasiel Puig is a different egg, and it's very, very funny to talk to him.
I mean, just the journey to get to America to play baseball of Puig is amazing. So yeah, I can imagine he's got some stories and some experiences that other guys who grew up in the U.S. and went through the regular draft in college or whatever will have.
Yeah, he has. It seems like he has plenty of stories. He said, "We do crazy things in Cuba," and I think that's why I play baseball so well and why I enjoy it so much.
So what I'm getting from this discussion is that the Yankees are playing the Indians at the worst possible time because they're a very confident and a very hot team right now.
Hey, it's a tough time to take them on. I know a lot of Indians fans were stressing like throughout July because the Indians had gone through one of the easiest schedules in baseball. July was super simple for them. And even leading up to it, they had played the majority of teams that were under 500 records. And everyone was thinking, okay, when they hit August and they have the Twins, the Yankees, the Red Sox, and now the Mets are on fire. You play all these teams, how are they going to be able to respond to this? Because they haven't really had a challenging schedule. Well, the Indians have done pretty well so far. You talk to Jason Kipnis about it, and he keeps saying, all I hear on social media is we can't be good teams. And it's like, well, would you rather us be losing to these bad teams? I don't understand. It's not us that's making the schedule, and just give us some time. We can beat these teams. And so they've done it so far. And it's a challenging time to be playing the Indians right now because they're on a roll.
Yeah. And if they do end up securing the division and winning the division over Minnesota, who's fading a little bit, I know Nelson Cruz is going through some injuries. I mean, each of those three division winners, the Astros, the Yankees, the Indians, are all going to be super tough, and whoever gets the best record is going to have to play, or whoever gets the second best record, I think we'll have to play Cleveland. So that could be a dogfight in the ALDS. I know, looking forward, we're still a little ways away, but considering the Yankees lead in the division, that's where all our minds are.
Right, and I keep getting the question all the time, like, oh, well, if it's a wild card, who's going to be pitching? And then which team would you rather be facing? And it's just so hard because it's so early to start looking at that stuff right now. Because when you look back a few months ago, and I think Major League Baseball, this tweet just resurfaced. They had tweeted out in May that the Twins had a 94.5% chance to take the AL Central, and the tweet was, does anyone take the 5.5%? And now Indians fans have dug that one back up and keep saying, yes, we're taking that. So to think of everything. Exactly. To think of the way that they've been able to come back now, and now, I mean, it's going to be a dogfight to the end between the Twins and the Indians to see if it'll be a wild card, a one-game play-in, or if they'll be taking the division. So it's so hard to predict anything at this point.
Good stuff. And I know you said this is the first year you're covering the Indians. Is this your first year covering a pro baseball team?
I was an intern for MLB the last 2 years. I was actually Brian Hoke's intern in New York last year.
Oh, nice. Hoke's been on our show a few different times. He's awesome.
He's fantastic. And then I was I covered the Orioles as an intern 2 years ago. 2 years ago. So this is my first time in a full-time position.
How's the grind?
I've heard some horror stories from people about your first year on the beat, and we haven't had any yet. So far, so good. I'm taking that as a win so far.
All right, good. Hopefully that stays that way for you the rest of the season. And if the Yankees do end up playing the Indians in the playoffs, we'll get you back on to preview that series. Thank you very much for your time, Mandy.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, We'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.